Thank you. I would like to thank the organizers for giving us the opportunity to give this long exposition of our work in the last few years. And well, this morning we have heard nice talks by my collaborators on Lord of the Rings. I couldn't refrain from making also reference here. I'm not going to assign names to my collaborators because I don't want to say who's the dwarf in the collaboration. I'm not, obviously. So you know that there are three parts to Lord of the Rings, right? So we've had part one from Harvey, part two from David, part three from Henrietta. So is there anything left for me? Is there any part four? Yes? You tell me. You want to do it? Okay, so is there anything left? Well, what some of you may know is that there was a sequel to Lord of the Rings, which wasn't written by Tolkien, and which carried a slightly different title, which was... And I hope that this is not going to be the case at the end of my talk. So I hope to convince you that there's still quite a lot of excitement in the field. So, well, what I'm going to talk about is fairly recent work by this same collaboration, which is Black Rings in Taubnat, which of course we call them Native Black Rings. And essentially what this describes is the downfall of the ring from five dimensions down to the real world of four dimensions. And I should say from the outset that almost simultaneously with our work, there were two other papers by Gayot Strominger and Jean and Bena Kraus and Warner. You can see by the numbers that they were really simultaneous almost, which described basically the same solutions but from a different point of view. So, well, these papers, like most of the work that has appeared on Black Rings over the last year, these papers, they complement each other very nicely, right? So we want to describe, we want to get from 5D to 4D, and the simplest way to do this was described by David in his talk. You take, well, I'm going to be talking during my talk for simplicity about the Black Ring in minimal five-dimensional supergravity, which corresponds to having the three charges being equal to each other and the dipoles also being equal. So this is the Black Ring that you've seen also this morning. It carries two angular momenta. One of them, the angular direction this, along the ring, I'm going to call it psi consistently along this top. And then you can take the infinite radius limit of this solution. You define a new linear coordinate out of this angular coordinate. And then what you get, you reproduce a solution that was found by Josef Bena about a year ago, which describes a supersymmetric black string. And one of the properties that of the black ring that is lost when you take this limit is that the second angular momentum disappears. But what you could do now with this black string is to compactify it, to make a circle out of it, and then you compactify your spacetime. You have now a non-trivial cycle in your spacetime which this black string wraps. And then when you perform the Kaluza Klein reduction, what you find in four dimensions is a black hole, a supersymmetric black hole. This black hole is static because you have lost along this process this second angular momentum. And the black hole, in fact, this is not a new solution. It belongs into a large class of supersymmetric black holes that was described by Bertolini and collaborators years ago. As I say, this is not really a black ring anymore. Black rings are characterized by this property that they don't wrap any non-trivial cycle, so you can contract them to zero size. In this case, this is lost. And then this other property is also lost, that when you reduce down to four dimensions, you find something that's not rotating anymore. It's a static solution. So what I'm going to describe in this talk is another possibility for reducing the black rings, where we preserve the ringness features of the solution, right? The ringiness. And this is going to provide a very nice interpretation of some multi-black hole solutions that were known to exist in four dimensions and which were constructed by Deneth and collaborators using completely different methods. Let us also work on stationary multi-black hole solutions in four dimensions, which are supersymmetric by these groups. But the explicit solutions that are going to be the four-dimensional version of the five-dimensional black holes that I'm describing were found by Frederick Denner. So how do we do this compactification down to four dimensions now? So we use Taubnat space as a compactifier. Probably most of you are familiar with Taubnat space, but I'm just going to give a brief review of what its main properties are. This is the Euclidean self-dual Taubnat solution that I'm going to describe. It's a four-dimensional solution, and it describes, can be characterized as a U1 vibration over a three-dimensional space. So if I suppress here the angular two sphere, and I just take a radial direction and this U1 fiber, then this is, it can be described, say, as a cigar geometry, where the circles of the cigar are non-trivially fibered over the two spheres to give us a hop vibration of an S3. Right? So as we go to infinity, this circle becomes asymptotic radius. The topology of the whole solution, this is this R plus, this is the radial direction, and then we have these S3s, so this the topology is R4. But the, as I said, the solution far from this core, this has an asymptotically constant radius, and this is going to affect the compactification that we're going to use from 5 to 4 dimensions. But then near the knot, things are just like locally, like a flat R4 space. So this is kind of a nice way of interpolating between flat R4 and the Calypso Klein vacuum. What you do get when you perform the Calypso Klein reduction of the Taubnat solution, augmented with a trivial time direction, is a Calypso Klein version of a magnetic monopole, just because we have this hop vibration of the U1 over the base space. So this property of Taubnat as a means of compactifying from 5 to 4 dimensions was used recently by Gallardo, Strominger, and Jean to provide a means of relating 5D and 4D black holes. So you put basically a black hole at the knot, and this, when the black hole is much smaller than the size of the compact Calypso Klein circle, this is basically a five-dimensional black hole, but then you can also perform a Calypso Klein reduction, and then you find a description in terms of four-dimensional physics. And they use this to relate the partition function of 4D and 5D black holes, and then since this, when the partition function of the 4D black holes has been related to the topological string partition function, then in this way they could find also a relationship between topological strings and 5D black holes. This idea of using Taubnat to compactify to four dimensions was also described in a recent paper by Bean and Krauss. The motivation was slightly different, but I'm not going to enter into that. And what they did in this case, instead of putting the object at the knot, at the tip of the cigar, what they did is put a supercube, a two-charge supercube, away from the knot, wrapping the fiber of Taubnat. So what you get now when you reduce from 5D to 4D is you get a naked singularity which corresponds to the Calypso Klein monopole in four dimensions, and then another singularity which corresponds to the two-charge supercube. So these solutions are singular in four dimensions. They can be perfectly regular in five dimensions. This object, of course, it carries a magnetic charge of the Calypso Klein gauge field. This object carries several charges, but one of them is an electric charge, Calypso Klein electric charge, coming from the fact that this has momentum in this additional dimension. So you have both electric and magnetic charges, and you all know that this gives rise to a pointing vector that gives angular momentum, which is quantized according to an expression found by Dirac, right? And this, they could check explicitly that you have this Dirac quantization. So now the idea is, well, if you can have two charged supercubes in Taubnat, then it's almost irresistible for us to think that you could have three charged supercubes, and these are, as we've seen this morning, these are black rings, right? So the idea now is to put this black ring in Taubnat. So this is like a bit like wearing the ring on your finger, right? That's, do I become invisible when I do this, or? No. So, what do we get? What do we gain by doing this? Well, obviously, now, well, we still have this Kluge-Klein monopole from the NAT of the solution, but now instead of getting a naked singularity, what we get is in four dimensions a black hole, a four-dimensional black hole from the black ring, right? And this four-dimensional black hole is going to be a supersymmetric. It's going to have a regular horizon. It's going to carry some charges, the charges of the ring, plus the charge that corresponds to Kluge-Klein momentum. And then again, since we have this electric charge of the Kluge-Klein gauge field, we also have the magnetic charge. We're going to have again rotation in four dimensions. So this is going to describe a supersymmetric solution, four-dimensional one, with a regular black hole and with angular momentum, and without—that's important—without any pathologies that any of the pathologies that typically accompany supersymmetry and angular momentum. These solutions, by the way, they have been conjectured by Bean and Krause in the paper that I just described in the previous slide. So why is this interesting? Well, you may know that there's no single black hole solution in four dimensions, which is both supersymmetric and which carries non-zero angular momentum. One reason for this is if you take, for example, the Kern-Newman solution, and you embed it into, say, n equals to supergravity, then you find that the BPS bound requires the mass to be equal to the charge, but then if you have non-zero angular momentum, then this corresponds to a naked singularity, and you can only avoid the naked singularity by sending the angular momentum to zero. So in this case, we can have all three ingredients, a regular black hole, angular momentum, and supersymmetry. But then you may say, well, in four dimensions, you have a naked singularity in here, so that maybe that's the price that you have to pay in order to have all these ingredients. Well, it turns out that this is not the case. You can hide the singularity by just putting a black hole at the tip of the NAT. So now when you take this configuration and you reduce it down to four dimensions, what you find is a two black hole solution with angular momentum, which is supersymmetry and which has no pathologies. This is something that we checked in detail. So this is a five-dimensional construction of a class of solutions that, in fact, have been constructed with a different motivation and with different methods by Frederic Deneuve and his collaborators. The precise connection between these two constructions was given by Gaiotto and collaborators. I should also add, as a side remark, because this picture may be a little misleading in the sense that it may induce you to think that the S1 of the ring corresponds to the fiber direction of a top nut. And this is not precisely so. It's a little bit more subtle. If this is set is the fiber of the top nut solution, and if psi and phi are the angles of the black ring, then set actually corresponds to psi plus phi. So it's a combination of the S1 direction and of the azimuthal angle of the S2, which means that the Kluge-Klein momentum is going to be a combination of the two angular momenta that the black ring carries. So this is a qualitative description. Of course, you have to go and do the calculations, construct the solutions. And it turns out that it was fairly easy to build the solutions because most of the hard work has been already done by the London group that we heard about yesterday. So this is Gauntlet, Gutowski, Hall, Pakis, and Rial. That's right, right? So they found a general method for solving large class, essentially all the solutions of minimal five-dimensional supergravity. And in the case where you have a time-like Killing vector associated to supersymmetry, the solution takes this form that we've seen in Harvey's talk. So you have this base space, four-dimensional base space in your solution, and if you take, well, this base space has to be hyperkähler. If you take it to be R4, then you construct the black rings in five-dimensional asymptotically flat space that Harvey described. But they also gave a general solution for the case where this base space is a Gibbons-Hawking space. And of course, taupe-nut is a Gibbons-Hawking space. It's a simple example of a Gibbons-Hawking space. And this is what we, what you have to use in order to construct these native black rings. So you just have to replace the, for their formulas, what you had before for R4. Now you put the new information that comes from having taupe-nut. So the solutions are specified basically in terms of, so you have, what you have to solve, you know, what you have to find is this function H and this one form omega. And these are completely specified in terms of three harmonic functions. Well, there's a third harmonic function that specifies the taupe-nut base space. But once you fix this, there are three harmonic functions remaining, which are harmonic functions in the R3 part of the taupe-nut space. Of course, there's some ambiguity, some freedom. So there are some coefficients that the some parameters that the solution carries. Some of them are fixed by regularity requirements. You want the solution to be asymptotically flat. You don't. You want it to be free from pathologies like these Dirac Meissner strings, which are global pathologies that may appear in the solution. There's also some freedom to perform coordinate redefinitions, but at the end of the day, you can find a solution which, I think that the most general one with a black ring and a black hole at the nut, I think it carries four parameters in minimal five-dimensional supergravity. In the in our paper, we fixed one of them for to get a simpler solution, but we also gave the general solution. So once you have the solution, you go analyze it in detail. You show that that the horizon is regular, that there are no CTCs in the solution. This imposes some constraints on parameters, but there are also some curious features that some of them we don't really understand them fully yet, but I think it's worth mentioning them. One of them is that these solutions, even if they are supersymmetric, they have ergo regions, they have ergo surfaces. And this is something that is a bit surprising, because some of you may know, well, there's for asymptotically flat supersymmetric black holes, you cannot have an ergo region. The reason is that well, these solutions have, they carry they have a Killing vector, which is basically the square of the Killing spinor that defines the supersymmetry of the solution. Turns out that this Killing vector is the generator of the horizon. And in the case where that you're when the black hole is asymptotically flat, this Killing spinor is also, or this Killing vector is also the generator of time translations at infinity. Which means that if this generator is the same as the generator of the horizon, then there cannot be any ergo region. But in the case of the solution that we have here, this generator of the horizon is different from the time coordinate that asymptotic observers use. And this difference is telling you that the horizon is rotating, even if it's supersymmetric. So these two vectors are different. There's a rotation. And it turns out that, well, the relationship between the coordinates natural near the horizon, the coordinates which are natural in the asymptotic region, are related by some kind of time dilation and some velocity in an invariant relativistic manner. Yes? Yes. Well, it's not an ergo sphere, it's an ergo ring. Probably you cannot do that, but I cannot give you an answer why you should be unable. Yes. So another property that's curious about these horizons is that they are not only are they rotating, but they are, or they are they moving, but they are moving with a velocity which is different from zero and also different from the speed of light. And there's kind of a folk theorem that supersymmetric horizons can only be moving either at the speed of light or be at rest. And it turns out that this is not the case in these situations. Maybe this folklore comes from solutions which are obtained by boosting other solutions. And this solution can, in this case, this velocity doesn't come from a boost. Another property that arises from this peculiarity of having this velocity is that the BPS relation takes a somewhat unfamiliar form. So here you have this combination of the mass and the momentum. this combination turns out to be the energy defined with respect to this Killing vector, but this Killing vector is not the one that you use in order to compute your ADM mass. So this, well, for example, for the four-charge black hole, here we're setting, as I said, three of the charges to be equal. So for the standard four-charge black hole, this is the BPS relation. In this case, what we get is something more complicated, and we haven't really understood in detail how to obtain this from a BPS condition. And by the way, this property that these solutions had an ergo surface and this velocity, this is also a property that the black holes at the NAT do have. It's not just a feature for black rings. It comes more from this property that top NAT space has to. Yes? Yes. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, this is a fairly recent work, so there are many, most of the questions that you will ask, I will say, well, we don't know the answers yet. You mean if you have both the black hole and the NAT, and we haven't checked that, but I think that it should be different. We haven't checked this in detail for the two black holes. We've checked it for the case where you have just one black object, but not for the case where you have both black objects. But that's an interesting question. Yeah, so it has to be the same then. Yeah, that's right. So another curious feature of these solutions is that the dipole charges that we've been hearing about all this morning, the dipole charges here, they are conserved. It's not like in the case of asymptotically flat black rings. And this happens even if the black ring wraps a trivial cycle. And the reason is the following. This is something that was discussed in a slightly different context, but with basically the same explanation by Gregory, Harvey, and Moore. Well, you know that, well, as I said, these black rings, whose dipoles are correspond to M5 brain charges, they can't be unbound, even if you're staying arbitrarily far from the NAT, basically because this is this S1 fibers over the S2 to give you an S3, and the S3, well, you can contract any circle to zero size. So you can unwind the M5 brains, even if you're far from the NAT. And what Gregory Harvey and Moore found in this case is that as you unwind these dipoles, or this what they were considering fundamental strings, as you unwind them, then there's a current of this charge that flows to the NAT. This happens because top NAT possesses a two-form zero mode, which gets excited as you do this, and this corresponds to the NAT charging up and acquiring all the charge that you're losing at this end of the solution. In fact, the dipole, the term dipole here, it's kind of a bit of a misnomer, because these dipoles, from the point of view of the four-dimensional description, they are monopole charges. So if you have this, if this is your Klutz-Klein monopole and this is the black hole, then you can surround this by a S2, which is large enough, and then this gives you a conserved magnetic charge. So actually, there's no issue about black hole uniqueness in this context, because all charges are conserved, and they serve. You can use them to distinguish solutions which have all other charges being different. It's also possible to use these methods of the London group to construct more complicated solutions. You can have several black rings wrapping top NAT. You can also even have multicenter Gibbons-Hawking spaces. And these, in general, they will give you multi-black hole solutions in four dimensions, which will have non-zero angular momentum. And with these can be constructed, or they belong to the family that Deneff studied. So I'm going to finish with just a few more comments. No more jokes about Lord of the Rings. So, well, there are many things to be understood about these solutions, and several of them are related to this property that we have this non-zero velocity, and these are the questions that you've been asking. In four dimensions, this velocity, it corresponds to a Wilson line, and in five dimensions it's obvious that the velocity of the horizon has to be less than the speed of light. It's not clear to us yet why this Wilson line that you find in four dimensions should be bounded above in the same way. Now, another property we've heard from Henriette about non-supersymmetric black rings. It's interesting to notice that there should be also some non-supersymmetric version of these natty rings, and it should be, well, these solutions should exist as five-dimensional vacuum solutions of general relativity. So now we're putting a neutral black ring wrapping the fiber of the top knot, and when you reduce this to four dimensions, what you find is a Klitschko-Klein monopole from the tip of the cigar, and then a black hole from the black ring that you have in here. In fact, you could even take the extremal limit where the rotation is fast enough to give you an extremal limit for this black ring. And this solution would, you can view it if you want to lift this to embed this into two-way theory as a D6 brain and a D0 brain, which are apart from each other. You know that this, yes? Well, from the five-dimensional point of view, it's easy to see, right? Because you just have to spin, the attraction would be that the black ring would want to shrink to the end of the cigar. But then if you spin it up fast enough, then this is going to tend to push it away from the nut, right? So from five dimensions, it's easy to understand. From four dimensions, it seems harder to understand this. And I think, well, at least my explanation for this, it's I haven't done any calculations. This is something that, well, maybe one can do. Is that, well, these two objects, well, graviton exchange is going to tend to attract them, right? You will also have a scalar exchange, which is also going to give you attractive force. Then the electric and the magnetic charges, well, they don't just talk to each other, at least at three level. So then what's left? I think that the repulsion, well, there's going to be a repulsion, because we know that in five dimensions you can balance the system. I think that the repulsion is going to come from the fact that the gauge field that these objects create it's going to gravitate and give you tension, and this is going to repel the objects. That's my conjecture, but I haven't checked it. That's the only possible source that I see for some kind of repulsion. Yes? Sorry? Yeah, that's a way of saying, because, well, the angular momentum is generated by the gauge field. Yeah. Yes? So this is an example of the D6-D0 system, which, you know, it's not supersymmetric. And in fact, it's, well, you could think also of bringing the D0 to the D6 and trying to understand better this kind of elusive black hole that you get from just pure Klitschko-Klein theory. Speak up, sorry. No, it's, I couldn't hear you, yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So that gives you some
yes. Yes. Well, yeah. It's more open string than Newtonian. Yeah. So that's another argument for saying that this. Yeah. So, well, as I said, I think that as the most senior member of the fellowship, I would like to again thank the organizers, and well, I hope that I have convinced you that there's much more to be done. As Jerome said, maybe for a few years we can still keep having fun with this, and well, thank you again.